Welcome back to the Daily American. Today we have, first let me apologize if there's any sound issues. This is actually my first remote interview. We got a bad motherfucker on the other end of this interview today. This is this man's a leader. He actually was my leader in the military, the guy who really stuck out to me. Who, you know, I think most people can differentiate like good leadership versus poor leadership. I myself was able to, so I kind of, you know, went under his wing, for my limited time in the military and just realized what type of person he was. So not as is he an awesome leader, but a bad motherfucker, but he's extremely humble. And I just want to welcome Sergeant First Class Christopher Takawa to the show.
Hey, everybody.
So, Chris, start with, I know you've had some humble beginnings. Give the audience or give the people listening, the very few people probably listening, the backstory to, like, you know, where you were born and your childhood a bit.
All right. So I was born in California, and my parents, they're from a small island south of Hawaii. It's called Palau. Out in the middle of nowhere, they're about, the population there now, I think, is about 20,000, which is much less than Asian elephants, which are on the endangered species list. So we're pretty endangered. So I'm a rare breed. But anyways, I was born in California. Both my parents were going to college. And when I was at the age of six, I went back home, which is 1988. And I pretty much stayed there until I was out of high school. So from 8 until 17, I mean, back home it's great. You know, like, I don't think anybody's poor. You live off the land and the ocean. You don't really have a lot of wants outside of a roof over your head and a full belly, you know, until you get much older and then you kind of get influenced by the Western, you know, sure, Hollywood and all that stuff. And then you kind of start thinking, maybe I do want something else outside of whatever the little island can offer. And so the easiest way out for somebody back home was always going to be the military route, because they pay for your trip out. And starting in the military, it's they give you, you know, like food and money and everything you need to really get started outside of. And we weren't rich, but we weren't poor. You know, we were rich in family, we were rich in love, but money and all the other things that a lot of people take, you know, like, yeah, sure, work their ass off for. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure some people, I'm sorry, some people in the United States may think like, you know, that's like a poor or a low socioeconomic, right, status over there. But realistically, your intrinsic values and what you guys value is much more important than materialistic bullshit and chasing, right, money and all this nonsense that we have here in the United States.
Right. And there's some great things about that fact, and there's some bad things about it. And one of the bad things I can attest for is that I was terrible with money. You know, when I got it and somebody needed it, it was very easy for me to give it away because it's not something I held very valuable. And so right now I'm at my almost my 40s, and I'm still kind of trying to get a handle on building a really good, you know, like a secure foundation for my children and so forth, you know, like, hopefully I make it in this lifetime well enough for my kids to not have to go through. And I'm not saying the military is bad, but I'm saying that better opportunities than us, you know, growing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, but from those beginnings, the military side of the house was very easy because honestly, my first bed was in the military. My first pair of shoes was my senior year in high school. They were hand-me-downs, but I have wore flip-flops my whole life. I walked to school. At one point I had only one uniform that I had to wash every day after school and hang to dry. But yeah, the military was so easy. And the only thing my grandfather told me when I left was to eat at the DFAC and save my money. It was two things that I never did. And I wish I did.
yeah.
If I saved my money, oh my God, I'd be living large, sitting comfortably right now. But we're still out here hustling, you know. But the military was easy because anything that really, they really expected you to do was to stay in shape and train and stay, you know, keep with your equipment. So it came as second nature to me. In the island that small, the community raises you, you know? So like my dad, he was paralyzed on the left. I think it was either the left or the right, one side, but he was paralyzed on one side of his body, but he was still terrifying. I would try to taunt him. At one point I was bold enough to taunt this old guy and he limped, you know, he limped, dragged one leg out the door, then yelled at the neighborhood for them to catch me, to beat my ass. And, you know, men just started coming out of the house. And then that was a big lesson. It was an eye opener. And I realized, like, you know, the community, they raised the child, you know? So, yeah. So it's definitely, it has its benefits, you know, because the military, it was so easy for me. Lying was hard for me, you know, like, so I did deal with a bunch of stuff in the military. I got a bunch of Article 15s, and not because I was a troublemaker as a soldier. I feel like it's because I just, back then I was one of the kids that kind of would just shut up in color. You know, I was very obedient. And so there were so many times, especially the field grade Article 15 that I got, it was one of the most damaging records on my military career that kind of held me back, you know, amongst my peers when I started to hit the E7, E8 rank. That I could have fought, and I really didn't deserve to be demoted. But when I look back at it, I don't think I would change anything. You know, it was a great experience from the beginning to the end, you know.
Yeah, no, Article 15, that was the one that that was like the bullshit. Didn't you just use somebody else's like gear or something?
Yes, that's what it was. I got to a new company. I was already in trouble because I was at reconnaissance school. It's called RSLIC, Reconnaissance Leadership Course. It's Reconnaissance and Surveillance Leadership Course. They changed the name of it now, but back then it was called RSLIC. And yeah, they let us go out at night and drink off the record. And so me and my buddy, one of my old soldiers was in Ranger School and I was in RSLIC. We met at a bus stop. He said he was on pass and we went to the bar that was like right outside the gate, which happened to be an off-limits establishment. So what they did is they suspended my promotion to sergeant at the time. And for 60 days, and as long as I, you know, didn't get in trouble, they gave me my rank back. And yeah, as soon as I got to the unit, they sent me up to another unit. I graduated. No, I didn't graduate. I had to get kicked out of the school, but the school was fighting to keep me. But my sergeant major at the time was like, no, send him back. So I went back, we deployed. But yeah, when I just got into a company and there was like a vibe, you know, as soon as I got there, I already felt like I was kind of out of place. The platoon sergeant that took over as my supervisor was already out to get me. Wasn't even the second day, first or second day. He followed me into one of my soldiers' room who was on profile. Back then the companies issued you your CIF, most of your CIF. So my rucksack that hadn't come from downstairs, the bottom floor, which is where our supply was. So I borrowed his rucksack for a 12 miler and he followed me right in, set fraternization, and then demoted me, took my rank away. So that's what got me my Article 15. It really wasn't, or my demotion.
Yeah. Now that was earlier. That was like earlier in your military.
Early. Yeah. So it was four years into my career. It took me a while and that wasn't even the issue. By the time I left that unit, everywhere I went, I kind of, you know, cause I was very decorated for a young E4 to E5. I had my Ranger school. I had my sapper school. I had my airborne tab. So everywhere I went, every unit I went mechanized after that was, there's this young E4, E5 that was tabbed to hell out, you know?
And yeah, hell yeah.
A lot of sergeant majors back then didn't really have that kind of stuff or didn't really care to go to that kind of school unless you were light infantry, like in the airborne units. So I did get promoted really fast after that. But when it got to, you know, the bigger boards that weren't like, you know, unit level promotions, that were more like a Department of Defense promotions, that's when it got hard. And I realized then how I should have probably went back and fought that I don't want to make this a sob story about my Article 15 years.
It's all right.
Yeah, no, but yeah, it was. It took me 7 tries to get my E7. So a lot of my peers and people that I grew up with are going to Sergeant Major School, coming through Bliss, and I was seeing them. A lot of my soldiers came through and became Sergeant Majors, and it was tough from that point on to kind of really excel. Because I already had this label over this kind of big umbrella over my careers, but it didn't deter me. You know, like I was always trying my best, being my best, putting my best foot forward. And, you know, what I just did is I imagined the Army as like a big family. Anybody that was over me, I treated like I would treat my parents or my uncle. And I thought about it as like a little community, like they raised back home. If I'm a leader and he's a leader and we're talking, I have the power and he has the power to talk to my subordinate and so on and so forth. Anybody above me, I treated like my elder. So it was second nature to me. The Army was super easy because I just gave respect where it was due, you know, like up and down.
Yeah. As I hear you talking about this, like, obviously I know how decorated you are. I don't know all the details, but I do know, you know, you are a Ranger school instructor. I mean, that's a pretty big freaking deal. Like that's not many soldiers have that opportunity. You also were in 17 years and you made your E7 at how many years in?
I got my E7. It took me a while. Fast tracking, I've seen E7s make it at seven year mark, you know, and it took me a while. Like I said, it took me 7 looks. So from my 7 year mark, which was my first look, to my 14th year. So it took me 7 years to get my, because of that.
Yeah.
The history, you know, like I feel like what held me back the most. I had that feel great Article 15. And on my record, I would ask Sergeant Major and everybody that supervised me, was like, why am I still being held back? And that was what it was. It was that I had a feel great, and they would kind of just like, they would look at records and, you know, they'll look at a bunch of people. And if you have this, you get set aside, and then they prioritize. And so it took me a while to get my E7, but I did get it. I feel like if I was still in, if the car accident didn't happen, I feel like I still probably could have made my Sergeant Major. Hope, I'm guessing I may or may not.
I 100% am confident that you would have. I also think it's interesting how, like, you know, you have this huge, awesome, decorated military career, and, you know, and again, take this for what it is, but all the, you know, all tabbed out, 5 deployments, and active duty for 17 years, and, you know, don't jump through the screen and whoop my ass again.
No,
it's odd to me that, like, you know, what you were talking about was the Article 15, which shows how much of, like, you know, not only are you extremely honest, and this is just a vulnerable thing in general, just talking with me, but it's crazy that all these awesome things you did in the military, but yet one of the highlights in your own mind is like the mishap or whatever. And it wasn't even really, it was a bunch of bullshit. I mean, you, Article 15, now keep in mind, he asked to use one of his soldiers' rucksacks, and he gets an Article 15 for that. Like, that's part of the military that, you know, if you're a decent leader, if that Sergeant Major or whomever degraded you, I feel like you can see through somebody and not drop the hammer on them. And you know, because it affected your career moving forward. I mean,
it did, yeah.
It's just, it's kind of fucked up in my eyes. But yes, 17 years, 5 deployments, Ranger, Sapper, Airborne, and on top of that, a Ranger instructor, which, you know, basically the best of the best Rangers are going to become the instructors. They're not going to just pick anybody. So I think I think your military record speaks for itself. And I served under you, and I know what sort of leader you are, and the type of man you are in general. Like, you know, even though you held that rank and that leadership, you know, when it wasn't about business or wasn't about, you know, if we weren't actively working, you know, you treated us just as if you were just one of us. And that's like, I think that's pretty respectable. I mean, that's how leaders gain rapport with their soldiers. And at least that's what I saw. I was never an actual leader in the military. But a lot of the things I learned from you, I will say, in the civilian world and management, I picked up from your leadership skills. And, you know, I'm not just saying that because you're sitting, you know, on this Zoom with me right now.
That's awesome, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of it has to do with just like how personally I am. Like growing up in the military, it was a different military. A lot of people use this kind of loosely, but it was really a different military. My sergeant major, before he demoted me, had told me that he had two or three Article 15s. Back then, Article 15s weren't a big deal. So when he told me to just, you know, just take the punishment, I made my sergeant major, you're going to make yours in no time. Don't even look. Don't even think about it. But right around 2005 is when we transitioned from paperwork to like the digitalized era. So we kind of like everything kind of, all the paperwork started kind of going away and people started taking DUIs very seriously. My man, so back then, sergeant majors would give you a safety brief, drinking a beer, get in their truck and drive home. You know, it wasn't. So I feel like I was kind of caught in between like a transition period. Where the Army was starting to take every little thing serious and stuff kind of stuck and followed you throughout your career. So I feel like it was a learning point for everybody. So I really don't want to point blame at the Army or anybody else. I still did go to an off-limits establishment and did get in trouble. So I'm not going to completely just like take the blame away for myself, you know?
Yeah, sure.
But as far as the leadership part, like for me growing up in the military, I got smoked the shit. And personally, it just didn't fucking work for me. You know, like I felt like I was a grown ass man. If you tell me what to do and you tell me the right way, if you convey it to me the right way, I would make shit happen much better than getting my ass smoked. And I probably would be so busy fucking struggling and sweating and you know, like getting my ass smoked, which happened to me a lot. But it just, for me personally, it just didn't work. So like I was more of the leader that tried to talk and try to understand what led up to the situation or why the situation is the way it is, instead of just like attacking it like old school type leadership. Right. But you know what? Hey, there are some people that require that. Require that heavy hand, you know, but like for me personally, it just didn't work for me. So I would always kind of steer towards that kind of leadership where I was trying to understand the situation and then figure out a way to better approach the problem as opposed to just kind of smoking it right, you know, like.
Yeah, especially when you can't smoke a rock or somebody that.
That was you, wasn't it? You remember that. You were one of the soldiers that I just got frustrated smoking. Like you, there's some soldiers that you just, there's no point in smoking them because they will prove to you that they can take it.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Yeah,
so yeah. I feel like you were definitely one of the, yeah, I remember that. You're the rock. And you're like, I bet you I can. Yeah. I think that was the last time I used that term.
You mentioned this vehicle accident that you were in. So you were currently a Ranger instructor, correct?
No, I had just left. I came back to El Paso. I came back to Fort Bliss. To take over the recon platoon. I was a recon platoon sergeant over there, and not for long. This is about a month or 2 months into my platoon sergeant position. And then my little brother had drove right into a parked tow truck, and I was in the back seat, luckily, because the engine had went right into the passenger seat. So it would have taken out my legs if I was sitting in front. But since we're on our way to pick up his girlfriend at the time, I just decided to just go ahead and jump in the back seat and not have to move when she got in. So that for me, it was like, it was a blessing, you know, like it could have been way worse than what it was, you know, like I could have probably not had my legs and instead of, you know, broken my neck, you know. So what happened is, yeah, I was in the back and I was leaning my head against the seat in front of me. And then when he hit, my neck just kind of rolled down and I bounced up and hit the roof again. So I think I hit my neck twice. I couldn't feel my legs. All I remember is I woke up and he was trying to pull me out of the truck. His airbags deployed. He was trying to pull me out of the truck, the car that Toon gave me, but the car. And I was like, I can't feel my legs. Stop moving me. And he just stopped moving me and he took off. He ran away because he just freaked out. But he was in the neighborhood right in front of me, like asking for help. The cops found him and snot and crying and everything. And they asked him if he was okay. And then they took me to the hospital. And then, yeah, they put me in that halo device. I had to wear that. I had some screws still. That's a screw. So I had to wear that stupid looking halo device for 6 months.
So is it normal for you, like after you, like you broke your neck and just one, was it just one clean break?
C1 to C3. They had to fuse the top three. It was the top three of my neck. So a lot of, yeah.
How long did it take? I mean, you're like a unique specimen, obviously. I mean, that's the truth. But most
people, they said that if I wasn't as like fit as I was, I probably would have been way in much worse condition. But I don't know if the doctors just said that to me, but that's what they said. They said that when you showed up, that and it could have been way worse if you weren't. Because at that time I was kind of starting seriously about like bodybuilding and stuff. I just started picking it up. So I think I probably had done one bodybuilding show at the time before the accident. But yeah, if I wasn't as fit as I was and now I started to pack on a little muscle. And so when it did hit, it wasn't as bad as it could have been. So two things, like if I wasn't as fit and if I was sitting in front, it could have been much worse. So I still came out of that and I thought to myself, like, as soon as I can, I'm going to go back into the gym. So yeah, 6 months I waited for the halo device to come off. And then after that, they had fused the top three of my neck. So for a while, I couldn't turn my head. But as soon as the fusion was done, I was back in the gym trying to, because, you know, I grew up I told you my father was paralyzed. So all I could think about was, I'm not going to be like that. I don't want to say that was bad, but my dad, he kind of died lonely. He sat in the corner and called him when we could. We visited him when we could, but I feel like all he really wanted was to talk to somebody. And he just sat in that corner of a little bedroom, living room. He slept in the living room, but he had a little bed and yeah, he just died. I feel like he kind of died lonely. And I kept thinking to myself, like, I'm not going to be paralyzed. I'm not going to be getting taken care of like my dad was. That was kind of my drive to go right back into the gym and get back into fitness. And so that was my first gig coming out of the military. It was kind of hard to find a job. That was my transition out. I was kind of still recovering. It took me a little over a year. After 12 months, if you're still on profile, they start processing you out.
Okay.
So that's what it was. So it was my halo device. Then after that, it was my surgery. And so the Army was like, you know what? It's been long enough. We're just going to send you out gracefully. And they said that I could have fought it, but my Sergeant Major is like, there is life outside. My Sergeant Major at the time, he wasn't my Command Sergeant Major, but he was the S3 Sergeant Major. And he was like, there is life outside the military. And I was terrified, man, because all I know is the military, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, I don't know what the fuck I was going to do with my life. Because in my head, when I was 17, I had already planned about my kids. I already started saving for kids before I even had kids, before everything else. I already had this plan. And the biggest part of my plan was retiring and getting a steady paycheck and then doing whatever the fuck I wanted from then, excuse my language, but whatever I wanted from then on. And that was cut short. So just shy of, you know, a little over 3 years left to my retirement. I had gotten into the accident. So that was me starting over.
And what year was that, if you don't mind?
That was 2016.
Okay.
Yeah. Towards the end of 2016 is when I saw it. I wasn't in full 17. I was about a month shy of 17. A month shy of 16. Yeah. As you said, 17, but I my numbers are wrong. It was 16.
Okay. 16.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine, like you said, that was your life. That's all you knew. And then, you know, it wasn't the five deployments. It wasn't anything else in the military. It was an unforeseen, you know, accident, back home. And it's like, you know, obviously, you know, God, universe, whatever you believe in had a different plan for you. But how do you bounce back from, I mean, obviously you did with your, you know, you're just a resilient dude, but how do you, you know, you just get back into the gym 6 months later? Like, these are the things that normally, I mean, something like this would literally destroy somebody's life with absolutely no recovery, nothing. They would just basically give up or quit. And, you know, I see you sitting there in phenomenal shape, obviously. You just left the gym probably for the second time today. You know, you have a beautiful family, and it's just like, how did you do it? Like, what do you think it is? Do you think it's just your internal, the way you were raised? Do you think you're,
I think it has a lot to do with being a good person, man. I think if you're a good person, you tend to attract like blessings, you know. Like, I feel like the only thing that I've done is tried my best to be the best version of myself around anybody, new and old. And so I feel like even when I was on my way out, I was still making newer friends. And I just kind of, I just started one day at a time, you know. First was to get back into my physical, you know, shape where I can work. But on my way to being 100%, somebody had noticed me, my friend Jacob, and he hired me on a job on post, which was in supplements. And that was my intro into supplements and bodybuilding, where I really started taking it serious. It was with Five Star Nutrition on main post. And that was my first gig outside of the military. And I did, surprisingly, I thought I did very well in it. And I was promoted again, and even considered for even bigger promotion. But things just didn't pan out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now I know you are, you know, a couple credits shy, one class, I think, shy from your nursing degree, which is a huge accomplishment, especially for, you know, obviously you have, an incredible amount of intelligence inside of you. If you're able to complete all these courses, get all these tabs, but not necessarily, I'm not saying that those always transition into the civilian world, but you found a way, or being, you know, book smart necessarily, but you found a way to not only be, you know, extremely smart or what have you in the military. And then you go, and nursing is a fucking tough program. I know people that have been in it, and many of them, haven't made it. And yet, like, you're finding a way to accomplish that as well. It's like nothing can be.
I surprised myself. I followed this girl I met in Afghanistan. Cause after my supplement gig, I got into contracting, and I did that for a little bit, and it was great. And I thought that was going to be my next big thing. That was my next calling. I was going to just contract until I was a millionaire, saved enough money, and then that was going to be my saving grace. But then something else happened there. So something else happened in the supplement world, and something else happened in the contracting world. And what happened was, and I'm just going to throw it out there, but what happened was I started traveling, because this is what I always wanted to do. I started traveling. So I went to Turkey, Hong Kong, I went to Bali, and
you saw some of the most beautiful Germany. Places in the world.
I went to Germany. I went to four countries in that first year of contracting, and I freaking loved it. And when I went to Bali, I got like a bajillion tattoos. Yeah. Which is a bad idea because CDC had put on their website, do not get tattoos in Bali. A lot of people in Australia are getting hepatitis and HIV there. And I happened to contract hepatitis in Bali. So when I went back for my annual exam during my contracting gig, they're like, you got hepatitis, so you got to go back home now. And
oh my God.
Yeah. So I got hepatitis. Thank God it wasn't HIV. It could have been much worse. Again, God saved me for the second time. I'm over here and I'm thinking, you know what? It's another blessing in disguise. Maybe it wasn't my calling. So I had to, and I got within that first year, I already gotten promoted twice and I was doing it exceptionally well in this job too. So everywhere I've been, I just excel. I've been promoted. And something happens, you know, like something happens. So, but what I started to learn was that I'm just not going to fight the grain. You're like, if my fate says that this is not where I'm supposed to go, I just don't. So when that happened to me, I had to wait at least 6 months for my body to clear, fight it off. Cause I had, you know, like when you get your shot, you know, like you're not, as a grown adult, 90% of the cases, your body fights it off naturally.
Okay.
So that's what happened was I had to come back home, wait at least 6 months, get tested again, and then go back. But when I'd come home, I'd met a girl that was going to nursing school. And I was like, well, I got all this time sitting around waiting. There's no freaking way I was going to pass this school. I'm just going to go to this, follow her to talk to her counselor and see what happens. And the counselor's like, just take the test. So I just took the test as a, like a whatever to see like how I
right where you would add up, even make if it you're into. Even if you were even capable of going
yeah. there. And and honestly before this moment I could have never imagined myself going to college. I just didn't think that I had the brain, the book smarts to be. I felt like where I was going to excel in life was where hard work counted, you know, like physical hard work. And so began my nursing career, well, nursing school. And it was great. It's amazing.
One class away from completing your nursing degree, which is incredible. It seems like we have a pattern here that no matter what life, no matter what gets thrown at you, you're going to find a way to move forward, spin it into a positive, which I keep hearing new voice and keep carrying on. So what do we have? What's next in store? I mean, are you doing any, I mean, you look freaking Jack Diesel over there. So are you doing any, are you going to get back into competition?
No, man, honestly, what it was is back in the day when I first started bodybuilding, it was just right around 32. I swore to myself that my best peak fitness physique was going to be when I hit 40, and I'm kind of getting close to that. So I'm starting to kind of push a little extra on my workouts and a little extra on my diet. I'm kind of like really being attentive to that now, because when I hit 40, which is in 2 years, I don't want to look back and kind of like eat my words. And this is all in my head. This is me telling myself at 40, I'm going to be in the best, not like just physical, just prowess, you know, personally. But this was a person.
That's awesome.
Which is why like I'm starting to. Also another thing that happened to me, which was last Christmas, is I had liver and kidney failure. So for last Christmas, I had to kind of like get away from all the supplements and kind of really focus on my diet, which changed my whole physical fitness kind of, because you know I kind of started to rely on my caffeine pre-workout and all that stuff, you know, and the doctor's like, just stay away from all that. So that's another thing, that kind of another wrench that
is all that
slowed me down, but it didn't stop me, you know, like we just keep pushing.
Yeah, it's like it's almost like an afterthought to you as well that it wasn't mentioned earlier, but you know, when I was down there in South Carolina, you did mention that to me. We didn't talk too much about it, but our supplements. I have my supplement right here in front of me. I got it from Apex Nutrition, which, you know, a buddy of yours, Vince Krause, owns.
Yeah. I'm rocking his shirt right here. He's probably hopefully the next guy you interview, because he's such an interesting and also very humble fellow. And it's crazy. Like, a lot of people look at bodybuilders as kind of, you know, like very, what's the word, narcissistic. But for me, truthfully, the reason why I really got into bodybuilding is because a lot of bodybuilders are actually really humble if you get to know them, you know?
Hell yeah.
And Vince is one of them. Vince is Mr. South Carolina, bro. He's from 82nd as well, you know? So
yeah, another 82nd Airborne guy.
Yeah. And hopefully, I want to listen to what he has to say, and I want to know his background too, because I haven't really had a chance to kind of listen and talk to him, you know, except when I go see him at the shop. But yeah, I'm excited for that next podcast. Hopefully it's not as long-winded and boring as me, you know.
yours has been awesome. And again, just want to touch on the main points while I wrap this up. I mean, basically, your ability to persevere under given any and all circumstances is pretty incredible. Your story is extremely powerful. Hopefully somebody hearing this can get something out of it. I know I certainly have, on a personal, professional level. And then obviously hearing like, you know, the humble beginnings and more details of your story, it's phenomenal. Sergeant First Class Takawa, here at the Daily American, we welcome you back anytime. And, we wish you the best of luck. Tell Kai, send my regards to the little man, Kai.
Yes, sir. Sensei, it was great catching up with you, man. Next time I have to drag my little brother onto your show.
Maybe, like, yeah, hell yeah. I definitely want to sit down with Brandon. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, my man.